We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Is of the Ten Commandments, and I sent it down to the secretary, and she's done it up for me very beautifully. Only I wrote nine down and had them in the wrong order. So what chance they have of me explaining the Ten Commandments to you when I can't even count to ten, let alone remember the ten, let alone get them in the right order, I don't know. But that's what we're going to be turning to in a little while, the second half of the study, as you'll see. But we need to talk about the commandments in their context first before we go there, because there are certain concepts that we take for granted. They are so fundamental to our way of thinking, our way of life, that we just don't even notice that they exist. And it's when you move into another culture and you discover what life's like without them that you realise how valuable and important they are. One of those concepts is the concept of a covenant, a contract, an agreement. And our society is at the point of losing this sense of contract, agreement, a covenant, because more and more people are going back on their words. Our politicians now tell us publicly, openly, indeed today some of them have been boasting about it, that you cannot run the country by telling the truth. You must tell lies to people. At the same time, they invite us to vote for them on the great platform called Trust Me. There's no way you can trust people who themselves are committed liars, who not just are like we're all liars, but people who believe in telling lies, who believe it is the best way of running the country is to tell lies, to make promises to people that you have absolutely no intention of keeping. And yet, come the election, they'll make more promises to us. Little wonder that the community grows more and more sceptical about politicians in general and the whole political process. And if it wasn't compulsory, how many of us would in the end vote? I'm glad it's compulsory, because it means the lunatics don't get in, just the liars. Covenant, contract, is a critical part of social life. The idea that you've given your word to do something and therefore you turn up and do it. Now that idea, that concept, which was just basic a generation ago, is no longer basic amongst us. More and more people say, yes, I'll be at the party, and just don't show. Yes, I'll do such and such, and just don't do it. And worse still, have no shame about it. Have no apology about it. Have no, oh, I did the wrong thing. I gave my word and I'm not keeping my word. That's a wrong thing. Contract, covenant, agreement is just slipping out of our community. But without it, life is very difficult to conduct. The contract, the covenant, always involves promises and undertakings. But the covenants that are legal covenants, the formal covenants, also have penalties for non-compliance. The way of undertaking a covenant is by faithfulness. You fulfill your undertakings, your promises, and you gain the benefits that come from fulfilling those promises. And you reward the other person in the contract sometimes because of their fulfillment of their promises. However, legal covenants are the ones that also have the sense of punishment. But punishment also involves faithfulness. So that when your parents promised you that if you didn't do something they would punish you, or if you did do something they would punish you, if they don't keep their promises, if they are not faithful to you in the punishment, you soon learn not to trust their word. You soon learn not to pay the slightest bit of attention to them. Faithfulness both in fulfilling your undertakings and in punishing those who fail to do so makes faithfulness the highest of moral values. The Bible is about covenants. Sometimes you can see covenants in this world between equals, at least so-called equals, like the ANZUS covenant, the ANZUS alliance, etc. Sometimes it's between the conquered and the conquered, like the Treaty of Versailles. Having conquered the Germans, terms were laid out for them, which was a covenant. It was a contract they had to agree to. They could choose not to agree to. They could choose not to fulfil the requirements and regulations. They could continue the war. They didn't want to continue the war, therefore they had to comply with terms and conditions which really were fairly unfair and unwise, as history revealed to us. Now, this concept is what the Bible is about. That is, the Bible is made up of two testaments, the New Testament, the Old Testament. The Latin word testament is the word covenant. That's the meaning of it. It's the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. It's the very structure of what the Bible, as it's laid out to us as literature, is about. There are more than just two covenants. In the Old Covenant, we have the covenant with Abraham, the covenant with Moses, the covenant with David, indeed the covenant with Adam is referred to. And there are covenants between different people. Abraham has a covenant with his neighbours and so on. The idea of covenant is a fundamental idea that undergirds the Bible, and we need to spend a little time understanding it. The pattern of covenant that we have before us here, because this is the Moses covenant, and in one sense, this is the Old Covenant of the Old Covenant. This is the Old Testament of the Testament, of the Old Testament. This is it. When you talk about the Old Testament, the book of the Testament, the book of the covenant, is Exodus 19 to 23. So in one sense, it's the heart of the whole Old Testament that you have before us. In other ways, it's not. But it is the covenant of the Old Covenant. And the pattern that you have here is a pattern that we see given between conquerors and the conquered in the ancient world. That is, outside Israel there were covenants. There we got covenants between Assyria and Egypt, two equal powers agreeing not to fight with each other. But you have covenants of conquest as well. The Hittites, who would conquer a people, would make a contract with them. We will not exterminate you, but you will now become one of our states. And here are the taxes you're going to pay, here are the things you're going to do, this is the way you're going to live, this is how you're going to be governed, this is... And so they laid out the contract. Now, the conquered people could reject that contract and go back to war, but if you've just lost the war, then that's not a particularly good option for you, so you accept the contract. You agree to the covenant. The pattern of the covenant we have here is very much like one of the Hittite covenant treaties with people they have just conquered, with a vassal state. That is, the nature of the relationship is spelt out between the two people, and then they gain agreement from the conquered people, yes, we will do whatever you say, and then they spell out what the terms of the conditions, the requirements are in the following chapters. So chapter 19, which we had read to us just a few moments ago, spells out for us the nature of the relationship. Chapter 19, verse 3, then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, this is what you're to say to the house of Jacob and what you're to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully, keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And these are the words you're to speak to the Israelites. There is the nature of the relationship. I'm the God who just conquered the Egyptians, rescued you. Now, I am going to be your God and you will be my people. Of all the peoples of the world, you alone will be my treasured possession. It's a very important little passage which is frequently alluded to and referred to in the rest of the Bible. So Isaiah 40 talks about being carried along on eagle's wings. And as soon as you remember that you're being carried along, as soon as you hear the phrase carried along on eagle's wings, it reminds you of the nature of the relationship between God and Israel, how he carried them out of Egypt. I'm the God who brought you out of Egypt, and you are to be my people of all the peoples of the world. So Moses went back and summoned the elders, the people, set before them all the words the Lord had commanded, and the people responded, we will do everything the Lord has said. So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord, and so the Lord said, okay, gather around at the mountain, come up, I will tell you what it is that is required of my people, of my treasured possession, of my kingdom of priests, of the people who are going to be Yahweh's people, the Lord's people. And chapters 20, 21, 22, 23 are the spelling out of the requirements given on high to the people of Israel. And it comes in really two big sections, the 10 words and the laws. For chapter 20 gives us what we call the 10 commandments, what the Old Testament, Deuteronomy, calls the 10 words from God. And then from the second half of chapter 20 right through the end of chapter 23, there are all kinds of what the NIV has translated as the laws. We don't know what to do with translations. The problem's just it's just the intellectual problem of languages, of how languages work and don't work. I think laws is the right word in terms of modern English. So I've got no objection to them using it as a translation. It's what we mean when we use the word laws. Unfortunately, it's not what the Jews meant when they used the word laws and the law. And so sometimes when the New Testament is talking about the law, because the word laws are here, we think it's talking about this and get ourselves miscued. For the Jew, the law is Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Those 5 books are the law, are the Torah. And they are the way to live. They are the meaning of life. They are what life is about and how you are to live in the light of God and your existence here on this planet. That is the law. And that is what the New Testament is most commonly referring to. Inside the law are these rules and regulations and ordinances given to the covenant people at the time of the covenant at Mount Sinai, which in modern English are what we talk about as laws. But that is not the law, this is just the regulations or the ordinances or the rules for the people of God who have just been redeemed and rescued. Chapters 20 verses 1 to 7 gives you the 10 words, which are in the terms of you shall, as they may have. They are absolute commands. They're not talking about rules and regulations on how to live. They are saying don't. It's not if you do, this is what's going to happen to you. It just says don't. You're not to. That's not on. That's never. But from 23, chapter 21 to 23 in particular, they tend to be the if-then kind of laws. 21 verse 2. If you buy a Hebrew slave, and he is to, if you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years. But in the 7th year, he shall go free without paying anything. If he comes alone, he is to go free alone. But if he has a wife when he comes, she is to go with him. So if you do this, then this is what happens. If you do that, then that's how you do it. If you do this, then that's... It's quite different to, you shall not commit murder. You shall not steal. You shall not... It's not saying if you do steal, this is what happens to you. There are commandments like that. There are regulations like that about what to do if a man steals. Chapter 22, 1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep or a slaughter it, or he sells it, he must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox. So there are if... then laws about things like stealing or about adultery or about murder. But there are these big 10 words to start with saying don't do this, don't do that, do this, do that. The unusual features of the laws, the rules, the regulatory part, to our minds, because they're not unusual, of course, they're just unusual to us, are things like the fact that it jumps from what we would call ritual regulations to moral regulations to economic matters to personal matters to kind of legal criminal matters, and they're all jumbled up together. We distinguish those out. So rules and regulations about rituals, like for example chapter 20 verse 24, make an altar of earth for me and sacrifice it on your burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, your sheep and goat and your cattle. Whenever I cause my name to be honoured, I'll come to you and bless you. If you make an altar of stones for me, do not build it with dressed stones. We'd say, well, look, that's just kind of church regulations. What kind of stones to use, where to do it, how to do it. But that's not what we would expect kind of governmental laws to be about. But then it drops onto things about governmental laws. It drops onto matters about slavery and economic issues. It mixes up criminal matters like stealing or killing someone. It mixes up that with personal injury matters of disagreements between neighbours and how you relate to each other.
and mixes that up with what we would call moral matters, such as seducing a virgin, which we say, well, we shouldn't put that into the law category. Now, that makes it a little difficult for us, and there's a couple of problems with it. One is, this law is the law of what we'd call a theocratic state. It's not a democratic state. The people of Israel don't sit down and draw up a constitution at a constitutional convention in downtown Canberra. And from that, they then have a referendum and they vote as to whether this is the constitution they want to live by or not. That's not the deal. The deal is God, who has just purchased them, who's just bought them, who's just rescued them, who's just carried them out into the wilderness, who's just made them to be his people. God says, this is what it's going to be. And before they've actually heard the rules and regulations, they've said, yes, we want to be your people. Tell us what to do. Now he's just laying out, you're going to be my people. This is how I run my people. And so here are God's laws to them. And morality and religion and law are all intermingled together. I may say in the modern secular state, it's all intermingled together as well. It's just the secularists who want to try and argue with us that it's not. And so in a whole range of laws are actually morality issues. Abortion, pornography, vilification, the marriage laws, the theories by which we punish people, they're all deeply and profoundly morality issues. And morality without reference to the supernatural actually never holds together as morality either. I do hope the law students that are amongst us see jurisprudence as the area for Christian endeavour. Jurisprudence is the subject that I want all Christian lawyers to get involved with, because our whole legal system works as a technology but has no real intellectual basis. So I hope that we get lawyers, Christian lawyers, arguing the jurisprudence issues, because really that's where the great Christian battle is at. Most Christians just interested in conveyancing. It's where the money's at. Now, the Constitutional Convention, you see, has raised real questions for us. With a little preface, the Constitution that we've lived under for a long time, nearly 100 years, and are still under, makes reference to God right at the beginning. Should they remove God or not? Well, for political necessity, they've all agreed to leave the word God in. But it's actually a philosophical necessity. To whom is the government answerable? Is it answerable only to the Constitution, a kind of compact that has been made in a different century by a different culture and a different group of people? Or is it answerable only to the people in the ballot box? Because what happens if all the people become immoral, like in Nazi Germany, and they vote in a monster? Is that... Or do we want governments answerable to some kind of higher moral law, that even if they are duly elected, if they act like that, they are criminals? And where does that higher law come from? Is it from kind of international conventions? Is that what we want them answerable to? And where do the international conventions find their answerability? Where does the United Nations find its answerability? The answer of our forefathers has been God. That's the answer. That even though you may do something that is totally legal, even though you have been elected by people through due process, yet you do not have the right to do it. And if you do, we will charge you before criminal laws as a war criminal. Now, unless you have the government answerable to God, you have created the monster of the 20th century totalitarian states. Because you will, in the end, elect a monster who will do monstrous things, and you've got no basis upon which to take them to war crimes, war tribunals. See, it's all still caught up together. Jurisprudence, please, friends, take it on so seriously. What we have here in chapters 21 to 23 is a whole series of laws. They are grouped. You can group them by a certain degree of content, but it doesn't sit exactly right. So chapter 20, verses 22 to 26, gives you some ritual regulations about how you make altars and where and what kind of stones you use. Chapter 21, verses 1 to 11, will talk to you about slaves and how long you can keep them and on what circumstances and conditions of a payment and care for them. Chapter 21, verses 12 to 17, has a series of laws about capital punishment. Verse 15, if anyone attacks his father or his mother, must be put to death. Anyone who kidnaps another and either sells him or still has him when he is caught must be put to death. Chapter 22, verses 18 to 27, gives you things about injuries. What do you do if people are injured? So 18, for example, if men quarrel and one hits another with a stone or with his fist, and he doesn't die but is confined to bed, the one who struck the blow will not be held responsible if the other gets up and walks around outside with his staff. However, he must pay the injured man for the loss of his time and see that he is completely healed. Or chapter 21, verses 28 to 36, talk about injuries by animals. For example, 28, if a bull gores a man or a woman to death, the bull will be stoned to death and its meat must not be eaten. But the owner of the bull will not be held responsible. If, however, the bull has had the habit of goring and the owner has been warned but has not kept it penned up and kills a man or woman, the bull must be stoned and the owner also must be put to death. It's the McDonald's boiling water case. About 2 or 3 years ago, McDonald's got sued by a woman who had taken a cup of coffee through the drive-thru, stuck it down between her legs, driven off, the coffee splashed all over her legs and burnt her with terrible burns on her legs. She sued McDonald's, but she was awarded millions and millions of dollars. She wasn't actually. She was only awarded about $100,000 or something like that for her medical burns. But there were penalty awards against McDonald's because it was about the 20th or 30th case against McDonald's serving water too hot in that circumstance. And they had refused. They just kept paying out the $100,000 each time because it was still cheaper than changing the way in which they served the coffee. So then that court case brought in a huge penalty award of millions of dollars against them so as to stop them serving coffee in an unsafe fashion. Now, that's the same principle that you have here. It's one thing if your bull gores somebody. It's another thing if you have a dangerous bull and you know it's dangerous. Everyone's warned you it's dangerous, but you still do not lock it up and it gores somebody. Well, you're responsible. It's the same principles that we're working on here. In fact, they got it from here. So there's property laws in chapter 22, for example, verses 1 to 17. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox, 4 for the sheep. If a thief is caught breaking in and is struck so that he dies, the offender is not guilty of bloodshed. But if it happens after sunrise, he's guilty of bloodshed. It's one thing to stagger around your house in the middle of the night and catch a thief. It's another thing in the broad daylight. You've got to make those kinds of distinctions. And yet, so it goes on. But you also get what I'd call categorical imperatives all there. So verse 28 of chapter 22, aren't we on? Do not blaspheme against God or curse the ruler of your people. Do not hold back offerings from your granaries or your vats. And yet these are all mixed up with other things that are in the if-then category. Run back to 18. Do not allow sorceress to live. Anyone who has sexual relations with an animal must be put to death. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord must be destroyed. Do not mistreat an alien or oppress him, for you are aliens in Egypt. See, some of them, there's a consequence that must be paid. If you do this, then that'll happen to you. That's what you've got to do to these people. Others, it just says don't do it. Don't mistreat an alien or oppress him. Gives you a reason, but that doesn't tell you what to do with someone who does oppress an alien. Chapter 23 gives you humanitarian laws about how to live in just daily life. For example, verse 4, if you come across your enemy's ox or donkey wandering off, be sure to take it back to him. If you see the donkey or someone who hates you fallen down under its load, do not leave it there, but be sure to help him with it. It's practicalities of life. There's no crime, there's no penalty that is being warned here. It just says that's the right thing to do. This is, even though it's your enemy, don't leave the ox wandering off and the ass wandering off. And then chapter 23 winds up with some, verse 10 following, winds up with some more rich religious rituals and regulations. The features of this law is that when you look at these laws, there are certain things stand out. For example, there are no prisons, and so retribution has to be of another kind. And so you get a fairly rough kind of justice. It's a common sense kind of retribution. You do that, this is what you have to pay for it. But there's no establishment of a prison where you have length of time in prison. You might say we've got a more humane system. We've got prisons. On the other hand, you may say that prisons are less humane than dealing with matters and getting over and done with in just a moment. Humanity is part of it. Humaneness is part of the law. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth sets real limits. You're not, the punishment must fit the crime. The punishment mustn't exceed the crime. Slaves, strangers, children, widows have all got rights that have to be protected. Some ways they expound what the 10 words in chapter 20 say. Some ways they go beyond that. But they do value humans above animals, which we do in our society as well, although Peter Singer, the professor of ethics down at Melbourne University, he doesn't. And so there is a shift today, and Hinduism, of course, doesn't. It values human life as highly as animal life, whereas we value, the Bible will clearly values humans above animals. There's a clear sense of responsibility for your actions. You must take responsibility for your actions, for the actions of your dependents, including your animals, and you must take responsibility for doing good. You just don't take responsibility for not doing bad or for the bad things that happen by you, but you must take responsibility to make sure that you and your dependents do that which is right. And throughout it, there's a consciousness of God and the covenant. Now, there are particular topics that we could spend time discussing because they are issues which for us we find difficult. For example, slavery. But you do need to clear your mind of the 18th century slave trade from Africa across to Brazil and the West Indies. There's a little bit of slave trade to the United States. That's the bit we know about, but that's a historical revisionism. Most of it went to Brazil and the West Indies. The vast majority did, and some to Europe as well. That slave trade was a kidnapping slave trade, which is clearly and explicitly spoken against here. You're not to kidnap. You're not to steal people. There is a different kind of slave trade, which in modern terms is bankruptcy. What do you do with people who have loaned money, borrowed money from you and are incapable of paying back? Our answer is we have them as declared bankrupts and they lose all kinds of civil rights and political rights during the time and they're not allowed to start businesses, a whole range of things like that. The Old Testament's way of dealing with it is put them into bonded service. They are to work for you. But they don't work for you endlessly. That's why they only work for you for 7 years. For the next economic cycle, which in Israel's terms is a 7-year cycle, for the next economic cycle, they work for you instead of for themselves because they have defaulted on their loans. And at the end of that time, you are to let them go, but you'll notice that you'll let them go fully equipped financially. They've got to give them clothing. You've got to set them up again. So they work for you for 7 years, you set them up again so that they can then start free from debt to continue in economic... that's the justice, that's the kind of slavery that is being spoken of that's here. Now, there are many of the kinds of issues, capital punishment that are here, the place that are given to women that are here, that you have to think through fairly carefully, free yourself of our situation, think back into their situation to see the principles that are involved here. Right? And so when you first read them, they seem, some of them seem a little strange, but it is well worth the effort of thinking through the nature of the laws and how they reflect the judgment of God. However, all this is the Old Covenant. What does it mean for we who live in the New Covenant? What is the place, the role, the value of the law today in Christianity? At one level, the Bible is two covenants. At another level, it's one Bible. The word Bible means book, covenants, the two contracts in the book. At one level, there's a conjunction between the two. There are two covenants which merge as one Bible. At another level, there's a disjunction. There is the old covenant, which has now been superseded by the new covenant. So, the new covenant that we have is the old covenant now written on our hearts. When it was given by God as the old covenant to Moses, it was written on tablets of stone. Now it comes by Jesus, written on our hearts. But it's not a different covenant, it's the same covenant, written on our hearts. But it's written to a different group of people. In the old covenant, it was written to those people who had been rescued out of Egypt, out of slavery, and taken through the promise. In the new covenant, it is written to people who have been rescued by the death of Jesus for their sins. It's a different group of people that are now being called to be the people of God. there's a conjunction, there's a disjunction. Forgiveness lies at the centre of the new covenant, not at the centre of the old covenant. And yet the blood of the Lamb is central to both of them as well. Jesus comes, you remember, not to abolish the law, but to fulfil the law. So we can't just say, well, now the new covenant has come, the old covenant's got no place. Nor should we say, well, the new covenant's come and it makes no difference, we're still living under the old covenant. It's more complex than that. The new covenant comes fulfilling the old covenant. So what use then is the old covenant for new covenant people? Classically, John Calvin spelt out three uses of the law. One, the law as a tutor, guiding us to Christ. He picks it up from Galatians chapter 3, where the law is spoken of as a tutor, it's spoken of as a school teacher, as a guardian, directing Israel to wait for the Messiah. Because what the law did was it convicted them of sin, it made them guilty. They continued to fail in their sinfulness. They'd been rescued out of Egypt, but they hadn't been rescued out of Satan. They got forgiveness through the sacrificial blood offered at the temple, but it kept on reminding them that they were still guilty because they had to turn up again next week for yet more sacrifice, for more forgiveness. It directed Israel to wait for the coming of the Messiah. And so, all who have the law, as you read the law, will find themselves condemned. You'll find yourself guilty. The law will declare to you that you, in your responsibility to God, are lost. And thus the law prepares you for the coming of the Messiah. When our society stops reading the law, which they have, then they lose touch with what's right and wrong. And they lose touch with how wrong they are and how guilty they are. And part of the reason people don't like reading the Old Testament is because it doesn't say nice things about you. It really says, you're wrong. And so we don't read it. Don't like finding out that. That doesn't fit in with the positive, affirmative kind of style of life that we want today. The second use of the law is as a guide in a sinful society. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, we see that the law has to do with sinfulness. It has to do with the basis of legal contract. It has to do with the world as God has created it. That is, the one who gives this law is the one who created the world, and this law reflects his character and the way in which to live in this world. Societies that ignore this law will create their structures to their own peril. To talk about law, for example, in no-fault categories, which is very common today in Western societies, has a short-term advantage. By having no-fault clauses in motor car accidents, it means that our insurance policies are cheaper because you don't have to go through the legal process. To work out who is to blame. You just say, oh, each insurance company will pay. No fault, don't worry about it. Short-term advantage. Long-term, it creates irresponsibility in drivers. Long-term, it's a disaster in the community around about us. It's not actually just. It means that we all have to pay, even though we're not all equally guilty. We're paying for the guilty. Indeed, no-fault divorce cases, same kind of deal. At first, it resolved a whole backlog of very difficult marriages that we really didn't know what to do with. But now, well, it's taught us that marriage is an irrelevance. And so fewer and fewer people are getting married, and so the whole law, legal structure is having to be changed, because what's the point of getting married? Adultery, there's no law against that anymore, so we don't have to worry about that, so it really doesn't matter. So we have a society now of single parent families. Even though we know that children raised in single families, in general, I'm not talking about you if you've been raised in one, but in general we know that those who have been raised in single families, single parents, in general have lower health, lower education, lower work, lower happiness, higher suicide, higher rates of psychiatric illness. Every factor, every criteria upon which you would want to judge the satisfaction of life, we know that being raised in a family with only one parent, you're a loser. there are individual differences. I'm talking generalities, remember? But we know that's the case. Yet by creating the no-fault divorce system, we have generated a whole generation of people who are being raised that way. Short-term gain, long-term disaster. The law is there to tell us how to live. We ignore it, we create the mess that we're in. Third use of the law is as a guide to Christians. So frequently in the New Testament, the law is alluded to. Some people say, no, we don't need the law, all we need is love. I think it was John Lennon who said that before someone loved him enough to shoot him. But love actually is fulfilled by keeping the law, and keeping the law is the way to love. Love is a meaningless word unless you have the law which explains what it is to love. What does it mean to love my neighbour? Well, it means I won't steal from him. It means I won't kill him. It means I won't commit adultery with his wife. It means I won't covet his goods. It means, you see, the law spells out the meaning of love. However, there are three approaches to the law. The right-hand side is going to be a great miracle today. Don't worry about it too much. It's only the Ten Commandments. There are three approaches to the law. Pharisaism is one of them. Pharisaism is that you are so concerned with the letter of the law and so concerned not to disobey the law that you actually fail to understand what the law is saying. That is, the Pharisees did not want to obey the law, they just didn't want to disobey it. And so they spent their time analysing the details of every word so that they would strain out gnats and swallow camels, as Jesus said. All full of rules and regulations about things that are observable, external, and basically meaningless minutiae. On the other hand, you can have the antinomians. Nomians are lawyers, antinomians, those who want to just do away without the law. He said, all you need is love, that's all. You don't have to study, you don't have to worry about it, you don't apply it today. That's the old covenant, it's got nothing to do with us. We Christians, we're forgiven people. All we're going to do is love and go and do whatever we want to do. Adultery, materialism, spiritual slackness is the consequence of it. Jesus is the third attitude to the law, and he believes in both the spirit and the letter. He said, not a jot, not a tittle, not the least mark will disappear from the law. I have come to fulfil the law, and he comes to fulfil it spiritually, not just legalistically. Therefore, he wants obedience to the full. And you see it in Matthew chapter 5, classically, where he says, it says you shall not kill, I tell you, you mustn't hate your neighbour. Because to hate your neighbour, to call him a raka, you fool, is to have hatred, is to have murder in your heart. It says you shall not commit adultery, I tell you, do not lust after your neighbour's wife. I mean, the basic reason many men haven't committed adultery is lack of opportunity, is lack of compliance from the other person. But it's still adultery within the heart that you are dealing with. And so Jesus is not concerned with minimising what the law requires so as to avoid disobedience. Jesus is concerned with maximising what the law requires so that we will see the full consequence of it because we have the Spirit of God writing it on our hearts. It's a whole different way of thinking about it. And so in the law, we find, it's not in this section, but in Deuteronomy, we find you mustn't muzzle the ox when it treads out the grain. Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 9 says, therefore, that means you've got to pay your clergyman. And you say, well, hang on, what's the clergyman and the ox got to do with what's the pay and what's the grain got to do with? Some clergyman and ox are very close, but what's that got to do with it? And Paul says, no, it's not about oxen, it's about us. And you say, well, how does he know that? Well, if you read the law carefully, you will see that there are two principles that are involved here. One principle is that the labourer, it deserves their hire, even the ox. Even the ox deserves its hire. And the second principle is that humans are much more important than animals. Given that even the ox deserves its hire, how much more does the human deserve their hire to be paid for the job that they're doing? See, he has understood the law the way Jesus understood the law. Go to the principle and see its maximum application. Now, the exercise I have for you on the right-hand side of the page is to draw up a chart, your own chart, where you can try and find a word, and I've given you, made it easy for you and said two words, a word for, a word against, which will summarise what the commandment is. If you can just find a word that says, this is against polytheism. This is for, you would think, monotheism, but I don't think it is. God spoke all these words and said, I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. There's the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. Well, it's against having other gods. It's against polytheism. You might like to put down then monotheism. It's for having only one God. But monotheism is a philosophical idea. The belief that only one God exists. It's not actually saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. You must believe that only one God exists. What it's saying is, you must have no other God but me. No other God beside me, no other God before me. I and I only are to be your God. I don't know how to put that down as one word. I've got for commitment so far. I'm happy to hear better words that are coming that I would hope that you'd come up with. But what's a word that captures what is meant there under each of the commandments that you come through? So the second commandment, which the Roman Catholic Church says is part of the first commandment because they divide the coveting one into two. But the second commandment is, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven or above or in earth beneath or in the water below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children of the sinners of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. What's a word that captures it? What's it for? What's it against? I mean, I've gone for iconoclasm. It's for the destruction of all idols. It's against image, which is an interesting concept because modern 20th century postmodernity is all for image as opposed to substance, isn't it? That's what politicians of today are all about. It's image, not substance. Maybe iconoclasm is not the word. Maybe substance is the word, but it's against any representation of the divine by imagery, by visuals. It could be representation of false gods, or it could be representation of the true God, but it'll still be false. God is not to be imaged. He's not to be envisioned in that way in any form. So you need to work through each of the commandments and try and think out what it is that each one is about. Ultimately, all of them are about love and hate. They're all against hate and they're all for love. So don't use those two words because you can pretty well use them all the way down. Right? And the first commandment, I've got to love God with all my heart, with all my soul, with all my strength. That's having no other gods before me. So I can use love on every word. That's because love is the true summary of the commandments. But please notice about the commandments, and I'll leave you with the exercise of doing it. Please notice about the commandments several things that God says them. But it is the God who got them out of Egypt. Don't make them out of their historical context. It occurs at a particular time. And therefore you'll notice you don't keep the Ten Commandments in order to be saved. They've already been saved. Now they're to keep the Ten Commandments to be God's people. The rescue's already taken place. Even in the Old Testament, you don't keep the laws in order to become one of God's people. You are one of God's people, therefore you keep the laws. Get the order right, or you get salvation all junked up, as most people do. That is, these are not eternal absolutes. These are the way that God's people are to live, having been saved. And so you mustn't remove the promises, and you might like verse 12, honour your father and mother that you may live long in the land, nor must you remove the curses like in verse 5. Each of these commandments I've taken through in a series of tapes. And you can get them down the, you can borrow them from our library down the chaplaincy, or you can buy the set of 10 tapes if you like, going through what the Bible says about each one of the commandments. I think they've fallen off the Christian agenda. They've been replaced in our public community by the seven deadly sins. There are no seven deadly sins. All sins are deadly. That's a nonsense. And the seven they've selected show medieval Catholicism at its worst. Right? That's not right. The Ten Commandments is what Bible believers are about. And I think if we did a little test at the moment and got you to just write down the Ten Commandments off just what they all are, I don't think you'd get all ten, would you? So it's about time we went back and studied the ten themselves. What I've given you now is the background for it. What I leave for you is the work. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for your great covenant that you made with your people, We do pray, Father, that we may read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest it, that we may think through what you require and demand of us, that we might live as your people. And we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.